you could just get a little enthusiasm. What a deal, huh?
My name is Ellen Cassidy, and I'm an enthusiastic, boundlessly grateful Al-Anon. I am totally blown away that there are this many people up sober on the 4th of July. This early, when we checked into the hotel last night, they said, Miss Cassidy, what brings you to Austin? And I said, well, it's Alcoholics Anonymous anniversary tomorrow morning at 9:30. And they went, whoa, is that the test to get in if you're, like, sober at 9:30 on it? I said, well, they'll be mostly sober people, you know, not, it's not a requirement. It's, we're Al-Anon. We get the best of it all, you know. Drink wine while you do your fourth step. It's, you know, it's great. It's great. Problem is, we don't want it. That's the problem. Anyway, I'm delighted to be here. I am just delighted. Your enthusiasm is catching. I could feel it outside in the parking lot. Well, fire. I felt it with David and Polly last night. Terry was great. He called me several times, and I felt so wanted and so well taken care of. And Daryl got us the best room at this terrific hotel, but he didn't tell me where it was. And, you know, it's just like, it's, oh, you'll find it. It's, you know, 35 and some street, and you'll find it. And you can't, you know, it's, that's the way they, that's the way alcoholics are. Just come on. You'll get there. Yeah, come on. Okay, well, I'll try. You know, it's, and you know, we got here. We found it, and Dave and Polly are the best. They're the best. We had a great time last night. And I have so many friends in this room. Old friends. Old friends. And new friends. And, you know, friends that I feel like I've known since we were children. Because I think we've grown up together in this program. Thank you for having me. I introduced myself as an Al-Anon, and I want to explain that, which is not exactly good news. Explaining things is how I got to Al-Anon. I always thought if I could get you to listen long enough, then you'd understand, you know. Then you'd see why my way really was the better way, and you'd want to do that too, and then we'd all be happy. The deal is God takes my what I considered my defects and can turn them into assets. He says, Precious, you have exercised that explaining muscle to a fare thee well. And so now we're going to take it out and use it. And he sends me out to explain things to little pockets of people on a regular basis. And this morning is your time in the barrel. Al-Anon isn't what I wanted to be when I grew up. I think from maybe even before my first breath, what I wanted to be when I grew up was I wanted to be somebody's wife and somebody's mother. And I was going to be the best wife he ever had. And I was going to be the best mother those children could ever have. And I had been in Al-Anon a couple of years before I recognized that never had I wanted to be me. I never wanted to be the best mother I could be. I never wanted to be the best wife I could be. I needed to be the best in somebody else's eyes, and it's an unattainable goal. What I ended up being was somebody's judge and somebody's juror and somebody's executioner, and none of us were happy. And when I got to Al-Anon, I didn't want to be here. Well, I never wanted to be here. I always wanted to be someplace else with somebody else doing something else, because I was pretty sure it'd be more fun there. I'd been in Al-Anon a little while, and I decided what I really wanted to be was alcoholic. I had a couple of reasons for that. Number one, it sure looked to me like alcoholic women had more fun than we did. And number two, apparently my husband preferred them. I'm not taking inventory, I'm just reporting. And so I really wanted to be an alcoholic woman, but I didn't want to drink to be alcoholic, and I had a couple of reasons for that. See, and if you're an explainer, you need lots of reasons. I always have lots of reasons. Didn't want to drink to be alcoholic because I come from a family of heavy drinkers. I come from a family where people drink, that's what you do. And they acted as if there was something the matter with people who didn't drink. You should stay away from them. They're fanatics. They might even be Baptist. And you know, I know today that isn't what they said, but I have selective hearing. You know, I hear what I want to hear. It might be what you said, and it might have nothing to do with what you said, but it's what I heard. drinking is what you did. It was a rite of bar. You know, my aunt's house across the street, you walked from the kitchen through the bar into the playroom. I mean, it was just on the way. And people got sips. You know, if you could walk, you could get a sip of something, you know. It was pretty much the only requirement in our house was a sip. So when I got to be an adult, I gave myself my adult present, which was 2 drinks every night. And I enjoyed most of them. I got to where it was the only thing in my life that made me feel like a grown-up, though. I felt like I was so underprepared in every other area of my life. But I had heard about, I'd gone to enough an open AA meetings that I'd heard about the line, that if you drink long enough, you might cross that line and go over to the other side, and that most people who go over to the other side don't get to come back. And I didn't want to take that chance. So the idea of drinking to become alcoholic was a little scary, and I didn't want to do that. Besides, I really didn't have time. I needed to be alcoholic that afternoon. The solution I had was pretty much the same solution I always have in my diseasiness. I think if I change how it looks on the outside, it's going to change how I feel on the inside. So all I got to do is change how the situation looks, change how you look, change how I look, change how the relationship looks, and I can do it all in my head. It's magic. It's magic. It's perception. And so really, all I had to do was look alcoholic. Okay, well now wait. This is the part where I have to tell you that alcoholic women saved my life. When I came to Al-Anon, I did not come surrendered. I don't know that many of us do. I came looking for one more thing that might work, one more thing I could try to get him sober, and then we'd be okay, and then I'd be okay. What happens is life, and what life offers you, I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but on an ongoing basis, life continues to offer us opportunities to surrender. And if you don't know whether or not you've surrendered, you have not. There will be no doubt in your mind when that happens. And just because you've done it once does not mean that's the end. If you're still breathing, you got another chance coming at it. And I always say, you know, if you haven't had it yet, just hang here, stay here. Don't worry, the next one will be a little louder, a little more painful. A few more people are going to watch you fall on your fanny, you know. But that's what surrender's about. What happened to me was I stayed here. And my chance at surrender came. And when I fell into that big black hole, I didn't have to explain it to alcoholic women. They understood. And it was an alcoholic woman who said to me, honey, those Al-Anons mean well, but they have no idea. She said, you need 448 through 452, which is the pages on acceptance, some of the pages on acceptance in the third edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, you need them every day for a month. Well, no, I still need them. I still need them. I love alcoholic women. So having told you that, I must also tell you that I came into Al-Anon on November 7th, 1981 in gorgeous North Dallas. And there is a look to alcoholic women in gorgeous North Dallas. So really, all I had to do to look alcoholic was borrow some clothes, because God knows I don't own any of those. And that afternoon, I strutted my stuff. I went out in my skin-tight jeans and my stiletto heels. And I was hot. Well, I made a couple of discoveries in that little experiment. Number one, I don't like anything that controls me like those pants did. And number two, Al-Anons really are doomed to sensible shoes, you know. We really are built for speed and not for looks, you know. If you love an alcoholic, you have got to be ready to go in a heartbeat. Or you could lose him, you know, and maybe kill yourself, but lose him. So the place I did that little experiment was at the Crested Butte Mountain Conference with 600 of my closest friends. I'm sure Marianne was there. I'm sure she was. She's the one who gives me hope for alcoholic women, is Marianne. And that week this was the early 80s, so this is like 84, I think. And there were there that week 4 people who had between them 125 years of Al-Anon, which was a lot of Al-Anon back then. Elsa C. was there, and Marcy was there. And Barbara Davis from our area, and Nancy G., who's the only one still alive out of that group, they were there.
And I hear stories and go to meetings with them, but I got to go to meals with them and spend time with them one-on-one. The most important thing that happened was I got to watch their interaction with their families. And I finally knew what it was I wanted to be when I grew up, because it's what they were. I want to be free. I want the freedom to be who it is God would have me be. I want the freedom that's offered me in step three, the freedom from the bondage of this self that scares me and ties me down and limits me and won't let me play. I want to be free. When I got to Al-Anon, they told me, the very first thing they told me was shut up. I don't know why that was necessary, but they told me, particularly with him, that I had nothing to say to him. There wasn't going to be any meaningful conversation. And I just needed to shut up. Shh, they said, shh, you have nothing to say to him. You can talk about the weather, perhaps maybe what's for dinner, but there can't be any strings attached, you know. Just shh. And the next thing they told me was that I had to quit diagnosing people as alcoholic. I'm very good at it. It's one of my assets. Really. I'd been in Al-Anon a while and was divorced by this time, and I had my very best friend in Al-Anon, and we were single parents trying to figure out how to make enough money to keep it together, and it was about the time that book, What Color Is Your Parachute, do you remember that? That came out, and the idea was find out what you love and the money will fall out of the sky or something like that, you know? And so we were trying to figure out what we could really do, and we were trying to figure out what we were really good at. And we went, hey, I know what we're good at. So we decided to open a little business called Drunk Busters. And if you wanted to date this guy but you weren't sure whether or not he was alcoholic, for a small fee we would go out with him. We were going to go for volume, you know. And if we came back thinking he was the cutest thing since sliced bread, you'd know if he didn't have a chip, he needed one, you know. And our sponsor wouldn't let us do it. She was like that. She was a real party killer, that girl. Anyway, they said, but honey, if it walks like a duck and it swims like a duck and it quacks like a duck, you need to treat it like a duck. You have gone around and let other people dictate reality to you your whole life, and it's time you start living in your own world. Well, here's what I know about that. The sound of quacking is like mother's milk to me. It's just comfort. What can I tell you? I am not happy unless there's quacking. I will hunt quacking up. If there isn't any quacking, I will find it. I love alcoholics. I absolutely adore alcoholics. Al-Anons are fine, but I love alcoholics. My parents, I heard them quacking. I'm not the only one who heard, but all that matters is that I heard them quacking. I have a number of brothers and sisters who quack. And I worked for a guy, I married a couple of quackers, actually. And I raised a quacker, and I worked for a guy who quacked in his office for 13 years. I would sit out at my desk in the afternoon, and I'd hear that, you know, when he popped that beer in the afternoon, I'd be like, he'd pop the can and I'd feel good, you know. I wasn't married to him, so, you know, that had a lot to do with it. But I love alcoholics. We have a tradition that says the only requirement for membership in Al-Anon is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. It does not say that there's a problem of alcohol. People will say, I don't belong in Al-Anon. There's no one drinking in my life. No. This is ism, not alcohol. I used to think when I was new in Al-Anon that, you know, this was back in, like I said, the early 80s, and the treatment centers were, you know, just filling us up. And I got the same fear that I caught it from the old-timers in the room who would say, oh, you know, you know, the wrong people are going to get into Al-Anon and they're going to ruin it. Well, we're all the wrong people, you know. Nobody can screw this. I mean, really. If you don't know whether or not Al-Anon is for you, just come. Just come. And if you come to 6 meetings and you start to think, oh, I don't know, come to 6 more. And if Al-Anon works for you,
Just know that there's alcoholism somewhere in your family. That's all you need to know. We don't have to find the person and point at him, you know. The test isn't alcoholic. It's whether or not Al-Anon will work for you. And it's alcoholism, you know. Our opening always says, we who live or have lived. Well, if there's anyone here who doesn't live in alcoholism anymore, just let me see you, because I'd really like to know about that. I live in alcoholism every day, you know. Well, anyway, gosh, I'm having a great time. I don't know what story I'm telling you. When I got to Al-Anon, I didn't have very many opinions. I either had yours or the opposite of yours, depending on what I wanted you to do. Today I have very strong opinions, which is neither good nor bad. It's just different, and that's what I'm offered in Al-Anon, is a different way of life. And if you want to watch the hair on my neck stand up, let me be in the room when some new drunk walks in and somebody says, oh, look, there's John, the new drunk, and there's Harriet, his little Al-Anon wife, twitching in behind him, because we do tend to come with a twitch, you know. And the only reason they call her Al-Anon is because she's twitching in behind John. She is not an Al-Anon. She's an alligator. Al-Anon is not a program for people who need it. The world reeks of people who need Al-Anon. The statistics are, which is another important thing if you're an explainer, the statistics are, for every alcoholic, there are 1 to 5 people profoundly affected. There are 10 to 42 people directly affected. I don't know what happens between 6 and 10, but I'm sure it's not good. Al-Anon ought to be 10 times bigger than AA, and it ain't a happening thing. You know, it ain't a happening thing. As hard as it is to get in AA, and I know it's hard. I know it is. I've tried to shove a couple of them through the door and couldn't get them. As hard as it is to get in Al-Anon, it is harder to get, in AA, it's harder to get into Al-Anon. It is damn near impossible to come and ask for help when there's nothing the matter with you. Is so predictable. Every time I say that line, the alcoholics go, they don't want to. They're afraid to laugh till we realize that we get the joke, you know. Yeah, we get the joke. And it's a harder place to stay because we don't come surrendered, you know. We come, my little Al-Anon group is the best in the world, or I wouldn't go there, but it's the best. And we pretty much stick to the principles all the time, and we stick to solution in meetings, and that's what we share in meetings. But every once in a while, somebody will want to tell an old war story about what happened the last time old George got drunk, you know, and passed out, and she poured fingernail polish in one of his open orifices someplace, you know. And old George woke up the next morning and went, oh, and he's been sober ever since, you know. And you tell that in a meeting, and you watch the newcomer go, she got what she came for, you know, one more thing that might work, and she's out of there. And you got to pray for the George in his inner life, you know, because he's in for a rude awakening tomorrow. But if that sounds like a good plan for you, it's not. That's not a good plan. The absolute last people to get them sober are us, their families, the ones who love them. We're the last ones. They get sober in spite of us, you know. Sobriety happens. Sometimes they trip over a crack on the sidewalk and they have a spiritual awakening and they're sober, you know, and some of them die. That's what happens. But we come looking for one more thing that might work. It's a hard place to get to. It's a harder place to stay. Al-Anon is not a program for people who want it. We have people who come to our meetings looking for one more thing that might work. Sometimes the laughter draws them in and sometimes the laughter repels them. Alcoholism is not funny. It's a deadly disease. It kills the people who have it, and it kills the people who love them. If you hear us laughing about stuff today that you don't think's funny, keep coming back. Because if you can't laugh about something that hasn't been healed, but if it's been healed for one of us, it can be healed for all of us. Keep coming. When it
I haven't told this story in a while. When Addison first started, we were a funny group. Babs B was one of our founders, and she's the funniest woman alive. We would laugh our fannies off in there. And the first couple of meetings we had, as soon as we'd say amen, the doors would fly open, and the alcoholics are standing on the other side. They want to know what we were laughing at. We were laughing at them, you know. We don't think they're that funny. Anyway. AA talks about step six, I think it is what separates the men from the boys. Well, Al-Anon is step three. Al-Anon is often accused of doing the Al-Anon waltz. We do 1-2-12, 1-2-12, 1-2-12. I know what the problem is. I've heard the answer. Let me tell you. You know, all those other steps, just filler, 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 filler. Just keep the alcoholics busy. Step three is the place where we go, oh, wait a minute. You know, we tell them, if you do step three, your life's going to change. And, you know, the newcomers go, oh, wait just a minute. Oh, there's been a little miscommunication. Did you think I wanted my life to change? Oh, no, no. My life is not that bad, you know. We're like people in a lake of liquid manure up to about here. It's not very pleasant, but it's ours. And, we've been here as it's been accumulating, and you adjust, and you readjust. You learn to stand a little taller, throw that head back, get up on those toes, and we maladjust. People come by in a boat, and they say, you know what, you don't have to live like that anymore. And we go, oh, no, no. They say, no, you don't. We can show you a way out of there. And we go, no, 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 that's okay. I just want you to keep that guy over there from making waves. See, and the part I don't like about that is the only thing he can kick up is my stuff. You know, I don't like that. Can it ever be his fault? If I have said that once to my sponsor, I have said it a million times. Can it ever be his fault? Nope. Well, quit calling her. So, Al-Anon is really only a program for people who are willing to work at it, because that's what it requires, ongoing effort. I'm an Al-Anon, not because of the people in my life, but they're what got me here. The first part of the first step is what got me here, my powerlessness over alcohol. What has kept me here is the second part of the first step, the unmanageability of my own life, the unmanageability of my head, the unmanageability of my fear that takes over my life. I'm not an Al-Anon because of them. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a 12-step recovery program that I practice like my life depends on it, because I'm convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a committed meeting that I go to every week like a doctor's appointment. And if you want to find me, you come Monday night to the Addison Al-Anon family group meeting, and that's where I'll be. And when I walk in the room, they go, oh, Alan, there you are. Sometimes they have to sit with their eyes because I can run late. But I know what they mean. And it's my group. You know, it's my group. It's a place where I'm loved and I love. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a sponsor who knows everything there is to know about me and then some. I have never told her anything that surprised her. And she knows she's my sponsor. I think sometimes we ought to have this little sponsor check. Do you have a sponsor? Does she know she's your sponsor? I'm an Al-Anon, and I am so grateful there is such a thing as Al-Anon to be. When I was 17, Mama diagnosed me as boy crazy. The place Mama sent me to be safe was Lubbock. You know, people outside of Texas just don't know how weird that is, you know. Lubbock. You know where the very first Al-Anon meeting was in the entire state of Texas? Lubbock. Yeah, Lubbock. Because it's a dry area, you know. That's a place where they tell them alcoholics they can't drink, and you know nothing makes them drink faster and tell them they can't, you know. It's a great place for a budding Al-Anon like me, because it makes hunting easier. You know, I'm always on the hunt for him. You know, even if I got a him, I'm looking for another him. Because there might be a better him somewhere. I'm pretty sure there is. This one will do for now, but there might be a better him. I was always looking for him. And if you're in a dry area like that, and you know, it wasn't even a conscious thought. It's just the way I am.
The place you look for the hymn is just right outside of town in those little gathering places. You know, right outside the city limits. You know, where they're drinking. And it took me 6 months to find him. But I found him. He was married to somebody else and had two kids and was 60 pounds overweight, but none of that seemed insurmountable to me. I really have never liked the easy ones, you know, ones who go, oh, you're so cute. I'm like, ah, get away from me. I want those ones you have to work for, you know? Those ones you have to earn. Those ones you have to make love you. And I can still do it. Don't test me. I know I can. I can feel it in my bones. And when you get him, you go, ha, 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 ha. And I'd be like that for like a week, 10 days, and I'd go, huh. You know, and that's pretty much it. Well, this one must have been a bigger challenge or something. I don't know. But a year later, we had shed the wife, the two kids, and the 60 pounds, and I had my prize. Oh, lucky, lucky me. We were married 6 months when he hit me the first time. He was drunk when he hit me. He was drunk every time he hit me. I didn't grow up in a family where adults hit each other, so the reaction I had to it wasn't anything anybody taught me. I thought it up all by myself. And my fabulous solution center here between my ears. I've discovered that the problems in my life are not really the problems in my life. The problems in my life are the solutions I come up with for what I perceive to be the problems in my life. Just let it unfold. You know, and our Al-Anon, we say it at every meeting, we get in trouble by trying to force solutions. You know, our solutions, the right solutions. The best thing I could think of to do when he hit me was double dog dare him to do it again. You know, it made perfect sense at the time. It made perfect sense for 9 more years. Because I'm a sticker, you know. I will make my bed and I will damn near die in it, is what I'll do. I don't know when it happened, but I know today how it happened. 9 years later, there was nobody left who could stand up and say, you can't treat me like this. I'm a precious child of God. I couldn't do it. I know today, after doing a number of inventories, what happened. Every time he hit me, and I believed what he said, which was, if I hadn't done what I did, he wouldn't have to do what he did. Every time he hit me, and I believed what he said, which was, I deserved that. Every time he hit me and I got up the next morning and looked in the mirror at another black eye or another split lip or another bloody nose and I said to myself, it's not that bad. I'll just stay in the house another day and another day and another day and nobody will know. Every time I did that, a piece left and a piece left and a piece left until there was nobody left in here who could stand up and say, you can't do that. And the reason I left him was because somebody came along who said, you don't have to live like that, which I had heard plenty of times before. But he added the magic words, and I love you. Woo! Freedom! You know, when I came to Al-Anon, there was a sign on my desk at work that says, Wonder Woman works here. And I tell people, if you've had a business that failed, you have had no alligators working for you. We are fabulous in our disease in the workplace. We will come in early. We will stay late. We will work through lunch. Hell, we won't even eat lunch. We'll take it home and do it on the weekends. We'll do our job and somebody else's. They don't even have to want us to. We'll just do it for them. When I left my last full-time job of 25 years, it took 4 people to replace me. Yeah. And I don't think they're doing a very good job of it either, but I've enough Al-Anon to not go tell them. I looked like the most competent person on the planet, and that couldn't have been a bigger disguise. When I got to Al-Anon, I think when we come to Al-Anon, we have one of 2 feelings. We either come in angry or we come in hurt. If you come in angry, you'll have to learn to deal with the hurt. If you come in hurt, you're going to have to learn to deal with the anger. It's the same feeling. It's just whether we've blown it out on you or sucked it in on us. I came in hurt. It was the only feeling I had was hurt. I hurt. I physically hurt. I emotionally hurt. I hurt. And everything that happened hurt me. And my sponsor would say, I'd be talking to her on the phone, and I'd tell her something. She'd say, how do you feel about that? And I'd say, it just hurts me. So she made me go get one of those magnetic things, you know, with the faces on it, you know. And if you can match your face to that face, it tells you underneath how you feel, you know. And so she made me get one of those and put it on the refrigerator. And I'd be talking to her, and she'd say, how do you feel? And I'd say, I don't know. And she'd say, go to the refrigerator. Go to the refrigerator, find the face, you know. And then trying to manufacture that feeling, you know. Well, the day came when I had a new feeling. I was pretty pleased. Picked up the phone, called her. I knew she'd be pleased. I said, I got a new fear. She said, that's terrific. What are you afraid of? I went, oh, do I need to know that? See, fear really isn't a defect. Fear is a great human emotion. It keeps you from running in front of trucks, you know. It tells you don't eat the live squid, you know. Fear is not a bad thing. I have fear of fear. That is a defect. I'm afraid to be afraid. Because when I get afraid, it takes over my life. There is nothing left. The fear makes all the decisions for me. Fear runs wild in me. And I'm afraid to be afraid. And when the deal was, she said, what are you afraid of? It was too scary for me to know what I was afraid of. But she did what she always did with me, was she said, I'll stay on the phone until you figure it out. And you know, I could do it with her. It's a we program. It's not a me program, it's a we program. And together, we can do it. I could never have done it by myself. And I said, and I finally told her, I said, well, I know what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid he's going to leave me. She said, why are you afraid? I said, well, he said he was going to go. She said, when is he leaving? I said, Friday. He said he's leaving Friday. She said, honey, let me tell you something. The way to know whether or not an alcoholic is leaving you is if they're gone. That was when she taught me about turn off the sound and look at the picture, you know? She said, turn off the sound, baby. It will confuse you. Just look at the picture. Oh. And then she said, and see, she believed that you should chase a feeling to its root cause. You should chase a fear to its root cause. So she would walk me through that. And it took a while. I mean, I can't tell you how long, days, I suspect. But it took me a while to get to this. But this was the way it went. I'm afraid he's going to leave me. I'm afraid he's going to leave me by myself. I'm afraid to be by myself. I'm afraid if I'm by myself, I'm not enough. I'm not smart enough, I'm not old enough, I'm not young enough, I'm not thin enough, I'm not fat enough, I'm not whatever. I'm not enough. I don't have enough money, there isn't enough time, there isn't enough. I'm not enough. And if I'm not enough, what will happen is I'll die. If I can't take care of myself, I'll die. And there was a fear underneath that one that says I'll die and there is no God. And so what I did was, when somebody said, I love you to me, what I heard was, I will take care of you. I will not leave you. I will stay with you. So it became life and death for somebody to stay with me. And when this guy said, I love you, I have my next one in sight. And I'm like the Mounties, you know, I always get my man. It took about a year, but I nailed him, you know, and I had him. And I knew what I'd done wrong the first time. And this, I had this little list in my head. This guy was the right height, right coloring, right job, right weight, right age, right money, right family, right everything. I mean, he was perfect. You would have loved him. He had one tiny little flaw. He didn't come home nights. But I'm thinking, you know, a couple of home-cooked meals and a little, you know, and I got him. Well, I don't know how you mark your territory. That was the way I used to mark mine, you know, back before menopause. Now, who cares, you know? I've almost forgotten what all the to-do was about, you know? But it worked. It was one of those tools that worked for a while, I thought. And anyway, we got married, and he came home every night, so I was pretty sure I was doing it right, because it is about me. I don't know if you noticed that or not, but it's about me. I must be doing it right because he's coming home every night. And then the night came, he didn't come home. Well, I recognize today that that husband of mine was a whole subset of alcoholic. He was a bar drinking alcoholic. And he was as addicted to the place as he was to the substance. And the night came, he didn't come home. Well, of course, it's all about me. So I threw myself on the floor in the bathroom and cried because I was pretty sure he'd seen the 2 pounds I gained, and that's why he didn't love me anymore, and that's why he wasn't coming home. And then I decided, stupid, stupid me. This morning when he said, what's for dinner? I said, roast beef. What was I thinking? Everybody knows pork chops are his favorite thing.
From now on, whenever he asks me what's for dinner, I'm always going to say pork chops, and then he'll always come home. That's what I'm going to do. And then I decided what I needed to do was go sit on the sofa and wait. Now, if you're in training for Al-Anon, you must pass waiting 101. And the way that you know you're in is if when you're waiting, you can't do anything else, you know? Can't talk on the phone, can't read a book, can't watch TV, can't, the kids would come up and they'd go, Mom, and I'd go, I can't talk to you. It's because I was waiting, you know? And I was waiting for the sound of those tires. There are 44 bazillion other tires on the planet. Don't care about it. Just those tires. And I can hear them coming two blocks away in heavy traffic. And I have the same reaction to those, to the sound of those tires that I've heard an alcoholic say a drink did for them. Because I would hear those tires and I'd go, it's going to be okay. He's going to be home and it's going to be okay. Now, my next thought may be, I'm kill him when he walks in the door, you know. But at least he will die in his own bed. And it was always preferable to be a widow than a divorcee, you know. Well, of course, he came home. And I recognize now that 99 times out of 100, they come home. It might be that day or the next week or 3 years later, but they come home, you know. And I met him at the door like a three-year-old who's been crying all afternoon, and you've said, stop it. I was at that place, you know, with the big swollen eyes and the snot slinging everywhere, you know. Boy, I think about that, and I think no wonder he drank. You know, if that's waiting for me at home, I'll just have another, okay, over here. And I asked the second stupidest question you can ever ask. The stupidest, of course, is, have you been drinking? But the second stupidest is, where have you been? And he said, Jesus, you knew where I was. But the truth is, I knew where he was. But see, my mind had, yeah, I don't know about what your head does in these kind of situations, but I suspect it's very similar to what my head does. My head had already decided what had happened to him. My head had decided that for some reason, I don't know why, he was driving his car out in the country. I don't know why. And the car, all of a sudden, just blew up. It just blew up. And it blew his body into this ditch by the side of the road. And he's badly, badly injured, and nobody can see him because they're driving right through, and he's down in the ditch. And he's bleeding, and he's not quite dead yet. And with his dying breath, he's calling me. And he's saying, Ellen, Ellen, I love you. And now wild animals are coming and tearing off body parts and shooting him in the forest, and it'll be 7 years before we can identify the body. Well, I came to Al-Anon and I called that love. You know, that was love. If you love people, you worry them right to death, literally. You know? What I know today is that's obsession. And you know it's obsession if you can take it all the way in your mind till somebody dies. That's obsession. You know what obsession is? It's all-out warfare on powerlessness. The more powerless I feel, the more obsessed I'm going to get. And I might get obsessed about the thing I'm powerless over, and I might pick out something else altogether. I'm an equal opportunity obsessor. I can do it about him. I can do it about my children. I can do it about my weight. I can do it about politics. I can do it about the weather. I mean, you let me get in the tornado season, and I can be, that's how I know there's a problem, you know, when the thought of a tornado just, anyway. But today, that doesn't scare me so much when that squirrel cage thinking starts in my head. It's a sign to me that there's a place in my life I'm powerless and I have not been willing to look at it, or able maybe, but there's a sign. Well, he said, Jesus, you knew where I was. Well, I did know where he was. He only went three places. He was at home, at work, or in the trap room drinking. But see, I have the ability to hold opposing thoughts and they never touch. And the two thoughts were, number one, he loves me more than anything in the world, because that's what he said. Number two, he's in the trap room drinking. But if number one is true, how could number two be true? And in my diseasiness, I would rather wish him dead than know the truth. And that's what I did. And he said, Jesus, certainly worked yourself up into a state, little missy. I'm not sure why I stay married to you. And I'm like, oh,
I said, oh, I'm so sorry.
Now, what is the matter with this picture? He is 3 hours late and drunk, and I'm standing at the door apologizing. I have an addiction to mind-altering men. Actually, it's not limited to men, I've discovered. And just about anybody can screw with my head. You don't even have to be present to win. You know. So we rocked on like that for a couple more years, and I got a call at school one day, and this lady was crying, and she was an angry lady most of the time, one of those rage-filled people, and those kind of people scared me before I got here and after I got here for a while, and I thought the reason angry people scared me was because they reminded me of alcoholics. You didn't know what they were going to do next, and I always need to know what you're going to do next. I say, I need to know what's going to happen next, and I say it so I can be prepared. What I mean is so I can be in control. I think if an Al-Anon had written the big book, it would have said lack of control. That was our dilemma. And I'm not sure it isn't the same thing. It's just semantics. But anyway, this lady called and she was crying. Now, if you want to watch all the alarms go off for an alligator, put us around somebody who's crying. Yeah, the primary alligator illusion is when you're okay, then I'll be okay. And I have to do everything in my power to make you okay. It isn't because, it looks very loving and kind. It's the most self-centered behavior on the planet. I don't do it because I care about you. I do it because I need a reaction back from you that'll make me okay. And if I don't get that reaction, I will try harder. I'll do it on Tuesdays. I used to take my clothes off. I won't do that anymore. I'm afraid it would have the opposite reaction if you do. I'll only serve pork chops every day for 2 weeks, you know. If I can get that reaction back from you. We have a thing at the Addison Al-Anon family group. We have a tables all set around in a circle, and we must have 7 boxes of Kleenexes on those tables. I don't know about your Al-Anon meeting, but somebody cries in just about every Al-Anon meeting in my group. They do. And people either cry because they hurt, or they cry because they've identified for the first time, or they cry because they're safe, or they cry because they don't know why. They just cry. And when somebody cries in our group, we don't shove the Kleenexes at them and tell them to blow their nose. It's a very subtle way of saying, I bet those tears are bothering you because they're bothering me. Dry them up. My sponsor told me one time that maybe the best thing we do for each other in Al-Anon is we attend each other's pain. We don't tell each other to wipe that look off your face and we'll let you come back to another meeting. Or if you get a little better attitude, we might like you share. No. That's not what we do. When somebody is upset in our meeting, we don't put our arms around them and tell them everything's going to be okay, because I can't make you that promise that everything's going to be okay. You know, the book says what I'm supposed to do when I get up here is tell you what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today, not what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like today, because there are plenty of times today when it still sucks, big time. Though it's different today is how I respond to it. So anyway, I didn't know that, and this lady called, and she was crying. This angry lady was crying, and she said, my husband is in a 12-step recovery program for alcoholism, and as part of his recovery, we're going to pay the school all the money we owe him, but it's going to take us a while. I just needed you to know it's going to take us a while. And I said, oh, that's okay. My husband drinks too much, too. I had never said that out loud to another soul, you know. The guy at the grocery store one time was loading the beer, and I had to go to the grocery store where we could buy beer, you know, and we bought 2 cases a week. And he would say, oh, having a party? And I'd go, no. Not a party. Just one guy. And he doesn't even come home every night, you know. And you know, and the problem, his drinking was not the problem. The problem was he didn't come home at night. But I wasn't going to tell anybody that, because I thought that was about me. If I was different or better or more or something, then he'd come home at night. And I sure wasn't going to tell her that. So I just said, he drinks too much, too. And I didn't know I was talking to somebody new in Al-Anon, and we're deadly when we're new. We got a lot of answers. We don't know what the questions are, but we got a lot of answers, you know. And she didn't read the book that said you shouldn't hunt people down. She hunted me. But she did it very intuitively. She said, you know, you want to go to a meeting? No, it's not that bad, And she would call every so often, and inevitably it was the morning after one of those nights, you know, it was one of those nights when he didn't come home. And finally the day came when a doctor said to me, because I went to a doctor, I had reached the place where all I could do was cry. Deciding what shoes to put on in the morning was a major decision. I would sit on the edge of my bed and cry over that. And I went to a doctor. I finally went to a counselor through my school, and he said, I don't have your answers, and the only people who might have them are the Al-Anons. And the next time she called, I said, I'll go. And I felt like I was coming out of the jungle with my arms up, you know, surrendering to the enemy. To a meeting, and I landed in a nest of winners. You know, they say you should stick with the winners. The deal is they don't all have name tags on. You pretty much have two choices, you know. You can either stick with somebody with good recovery or stick with somebody who doesn't have good recovery, but you don't know what that is for a while. I landed in a nest of winners. I landed in a nest of folks who didn't go to just one Al-Anon meeting a week. I landed in a nest of folks who went to open AA meetings regularly. Thank God for open AA meetings. I landed in a nest of folks who went to conferences, and they would call. I thought the first step in the program was get in the car, because they'd call me up and they'd say, so-and-so is doing the steps across town on Thursday. Oh, especially the shut up part made him really happy, you know. I got a call one Monday morning from a lady who was just furious. She was furious. She said, I want to talk to you. She said, your husband has been out here with my husband all weekend long drinking. And I said to him, how can you do this? How can you treat your wife like this? How can she put up with this kind of behavior? And he said, you'd found a way and I should call you. He was 12-stepping for Al-Anon, you know. She was too angry. She was too angry. She did not want to let go of that anger. It was all the power she had, so she could not stay. Anyway, a couple of years later, I got I went through the dark night of the soul. I finally landed in the big black hole, and that was the year I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was 38 years old. I was too young. There's no history of it in my family. I'm the first. I'm the only. I've hung my life on a couple of lines out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a big book Al-Anon. My sponsor came. I am preaching to the choir. For those of you who don't know, the big book is not conference approved literature for Al-Anon because it was not written by an Al-Anon. Really? However, we have a tradition that says that we're supposed to work the steps of AA ourselves. Hello, do you know where the instructions are? Hidden very carefully in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor came into Al-Anon when there wasn't any Al-Anon. She came in when when all there were AA meetings, and she had alcoholic women who sponsored her, and she was sponsored through the big book, and that's the way she sponsored us. I think if you want to know how to work the program, that's where the directions are. I think if you want to read a description of alcoholism, that's where the description is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want to know how it affects the family, don't read the chapter to the wives. Read How Al-Anon Works for Families and Friends of Alcoholics. That'll tell you how it affects the families. Anyway, I've hung my life on a couple of lines out of that. One of them is nothing but nothing happens by accident in God's world. Oh, how I love that. And the other one is the last column of the four-step inventory that basically says, what was your part? What was your contribution? I had a hard time with the idea of mistake, but I believe that is the word it says in there. It's mistake. What did you do? It was the first time I recognized that I have a part in everything that happens in my life. There are some places where I'm a helpless victim. In other places where I have a heart part, I always have a part. And my sponsor said, you are only responsible for your part. What an empowering thing that is to know, that all I'm responsible for is my part. And I wanted to know what my part was in the cancer. They'd given me a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. And I went through the steps. I got in the step study and did the steps. It's the only way I know how to live my life, are those written directions. And what I discovered in that inventory is that there were studies then that said cancer was a stress-related disease. Cancer is prevalent in alcoholic homes. And you know who uses the insurance first in an alcoholic home? The non-alcoholic. Alcoholics have blessed moments of blackout. Not us. We're awake and paying attention. Some of us are even taking notes. And I was blessed with doctors who didn't try to tell me why I had cancer. They let me figure it out for myself, just like alcoholism. And what I did as a result of doing the steps, what I recognized was that the cancer I had was a stress-caused cancer. There's nothing more stressful for me than living in active alcoholism. And so for the first time, I meant what I said. I'd said it 1,000 other times, but I said, if you can't stay sober, you can't stay here. And he was so alcoholic, he said, let me think about it. What's the reason? No. This is not up for discussion. And he moved out. And if you ask him why he moved out, he would have told you it was that crazy daughter of mine. Anyone who had to live with that little wench would drink too. Well, I didn't drink and live with her. I just closed the door to her room, you know, the pit. We had an agreement that as long as she didn't lower my property value, she could do whatever she wanted to in there. The minute she lowered the property value, I'm coming in. And I thought she was crazy, you know. I knew she was crazy. For instance, there was one Saturday morning she came home, should have been home Friday night. Do you see the pattern in my life? If I had gotten alcoholics who sat in their chair and drank and passed out, I'd be dead. But I didn't. I got alcoholics who didn't come home at night. And it's exactly the spiritual path I needed to be on. Here was this daughter of mine, should have come home Friday night, didn't, came home Saturday morning, long before cell phones. But I'd been in Al-Anon long enough to get the message that you didn't have to go looking for bad news. It's perfectly capable of making the entire journey to you. You don't have to call all the hospitals and see if she's there, you know. So I wasn't calling around to see where she was. And she came home the next morning, and, you know, and she's, Mom, it was terrible. We were just driving down the road minding our own business, Mom, really. We weren't bothering anybody, and this car came along from somewhere. I don't know where. It was just nowhere. We didn't know them. And they tried to shove us off the road, Mom. It was really, 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 really scary. And the police came, and they said it wasn't our fault or anything, Mom. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, is everybody okay? Yeah, Mom, we're all fine. I'm a little tired. I'm just going to my room. You know, and I'm in the living room with you know, because that's what I do. Bring me your extra feelings, please. Let me bear them for you, you know. And I knew she was crazy. A couple of years later, they called from the school. They said, there's something the matter with your daughter. Duh. And they said, we're going to send her for an evaluation. Really? 2 days later, the treatment center calls, and they say, Miss Davis, we have bad news for you. We really do believe your daughter's alcoholic. And I'm like, yes. And they said, we've not had a lot of mothers react just like that. Oh, I'm so thrilled. It's alcoholism. Yay! I thought she was crazy. Al-Anon disease. No sign she'll ever get any help for that, you know. But she's alcoholic. Yes. And she's 17. I can make her do stuff, you know. Took her to a place that would force feed the steps into her because it's the only thing I knew that might work. Statistics are that 80% of the young people who come in today have to go back out because they're not done, you know. And I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous does what it does for the reason it does and not for some kind of success rate. My daughter was one of those who stayed sober about a year and a half, and then she had to go back out. And she came back in January 29th, 1990. I had nothing to do with it, and you had everything to do with it. The best thing I ever did for that child was get a program and get a life and get out of her way and let her do what she needed to do. Because the alcoholics didn't treat her like she was too young when she came the first time. They didn't treat her like she hadn't suffered long enough. Apparently, any suffering is enough. They didn't treat her like because she did drugs, it somehow negated her alcoholism. Melissa got sober twice before it was ever legal for her to drink once. It was easier to get drugs than it was alcohol. But my daughter is an alcoholic. One of the sure signs is how much I love her. She has had 18 years of continuous sobriety, and she is a very active member of her AA group. And, you know, she had me introduce her at her third birthday, and I remember standing up there looking at her thinking, you know what, if God had given me the daughter I designed, the daughter I wanted, how short I would have sold us both, you know. God, she's a fabulous girl. She's alcoholic all the time, but she's wonderful. She's absolutely wonderful. The first time she was sober, oh, there's so much story left. I'm so sorry you're not going to get it all. Too bad. Well, When she was sober the first time, she started hanging out in slippery places with slippery people, and I just knew if she drank, I'd die, because that's how it felt. If she starts drinking again, I'll die. And so for the first time, I meant it and said it for the 1,000th time. If you can't go by the rules in this house, you can't stay here. If you can't be a contributing member to this household, you can't stay here. And she called me one night and said, we got to have $300 by tomorrow or else. You know, and I didn't have $300 to give her for the next day. And I planned the day for her deadline to be the day I was leaving to go to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends, because I didn't want to kick my daughter out. I adore my daughter. I wanted her happy, healthy, home and whole, and she couldn't do any of that, you know. And that was the morning she threw herself across my bed and said, you're going to be a grandmother. She was 18 and she was pregnant, and we both thought that changed everything. Now she'd stay home and I'd have to take care of her and be responsible, and I was furious. I was furious and terrified, absolutely terrified. If she stays here, I'll die. It took me a couple of hours before I picked up the phone and called my sponsor and turned myself in. But I finally did. And she said to me, do you want her to stay? And I said, no, I don't want her to stay. I said, shouldn't a mother want her? She said, honey, there are only so many bad feelings in each relationship. Those are her feelings. Let her have them. And she said, if you don't want us, you don't want her to stay, I'll stay on the phone while you tell her. What she taught me was, Ellen, I'd say, I don't know what to do. And she'd say, yes, you do. Take everybody else out of the picture. Now what do you want to do? And I knew what I wanted to do when I took everybody else out of the picture. Didn't mean I have to do it, but I need to know what it is. And the truth is, I didn't want her to stay. I did not want her to stay. That's how resentment gets born, is when I do things that aren't right for me. You know, God, the God of my understanding, doesn't have things that are right for one person and bad for another person. God always has win-win deals. And so if it's what feels like it's best for me, it's got to be best for them, whether they think so or not, you know. And then that's the deal. And I know what's right, and you know what's right, and you know what's right, and you know what's right. We know what's right. We know how it ought to look. But God knows what's best. And if I leave it up to God, that's what will happen. Is the best thing, not necessarily the right thing. So I told her she couldn't stay, and she moved out, which is sort of a joke because she crawled in through the window for months to come. But anyway, we went through a bad fall, and she told people what a horrible mother I was. She was pregnant, and I wouldn't let her stay at home. And I would do things like, I went to the Brazos Riverside Conference, and my friend Buddy Ross was taping, and I said, Buddy, I was serious as a stroke too. I said, Buddy, she's pregnant at me. It's all about me. And he said, God love Buddy, he said, he was serious as I was, and he said, honey, I understand. He said, you know what? Our son's girlfriend had a baby out of wedlock, and that child has been the light of our lives. It never occurred to me I might like it. I love babies. I've always loved babies, and until recently hadn't had my fill. And here God was. Here God was offering me a baby, and I'm doing the yeah but thing. You know, I think the sanity offered me in step two may be nothing short of paradise, but the reason I don't get paradise is yeah but, you know. Yeah, but not like this God, not today God, not this child, and she's too young. This shouldn't happen. I'm telling God how to run the universe, you know. Yeah, but my journey in Al-Anon has been the journey from yeah but to thank you. Thank you. Thank you for everything exactly as it is, you know. And then that for me today is the definition of acceptance, is thank you. Thank you for it all exactly as it is. I wouldn't change a thing, not a thing. So we rocked on for a couple more months, and I decided I'd say thank you for the baby. And a couple months later, she called and said, Mom, I had a sonogram this morning. You know that blue blanket you're knitting? You're going to have to knit a little faster. It's twin boys. You know them alcoholics. If one's good, let's have another. You know, and I think about that, and I think, you know, if she just had one baby, you'd have another speaker. You know, my life would have gone, but she had two, and that was even too much for me. What an order, you know. I can't go through with it. The boys, she came and lived with me right after the babies were born because they were several weeks premature, and I wanted peace of mind, and I knew that no one was going to give me peace of mind, and I would have more peace of mind knowing where she was and where she wasn't. So I said, you come stay with me till you get the hang of twins, but I don't know how a 19-year-old who didn't even like dolls was going to get the hang of twins, you know. And when they were 5 weeks old, she said, Mom, I'm not going to keep them, and you can have them. And, you know, and if you've never been loved by an Al-Anon, you don't know what you're missing. We love at a cellular level, you know. And that's the way I love those babies. I'd fallen in love with heartbeats in the hospital, you know. I love those babies. I still love those babies. She said, you can have them. I did a lot of writing. I did a lot of praying. I did a lot of talking to my sponsor. And my sponsor had been telling me for years that God wants for me what I want for me in my heart of hearts. But I'm such an Al-Anon. I'm so afraid to make the decision. But what if it's the wrong decision? What if next week something better comes along and I'm stuck because I picked this thing last week? I don't know what to do. So, you know, then the alcoholics end up making all the decisions. And, you know, then you get pissed because they made all the decisions, you know. But you didn't make any. If you want to watch something painful, watch a group of Al-Anons try to decide where to go for lunch. They're double winners, you know. Or Polly, who'd walk up and say, Mexican food, we're going for Mexican food. Oh, good, just what I want. You know, and off we go. My sponsor said, honey, the deal is you walk in the direction of your dreams. That deal is where you get. God's promise is this or something better. God is not a terrorist waiting around the corner to test your patience. God wants this or something better for you. Well, you know what? I didn't want to raise them. I'm through raising kids. They're the children of two addicts, and I didn't like the odds. But I wouldn't give up being their grandma if I could possibly help it. So she moved out and gave me power of attorney, and I went to adoption agencies, and I said, I'm looking for a family that wants two babies and a grandmother. But I finally found the place, you know, who said, if that's what, they worked with me, they were Lutheran Services, just was wonderful with me and with Melissa. And a year, they let me pick the day to surrender the babies. They were nearly 5 months old at that point. They knew me, they knew the sound of my voice. And it was the hardest thing I ever did to give up those babies. The day I picked to surrender them was the day I was going to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends because I needed intensive care. The boys are 20 years old now. They were 20 years old this last March. And the parents don't believe in alcoholism. They don't understand this disease. The last few years, the boys went into public school in the ninth grade, and it's been pretty exciting since then. The parents have aged incredibly in the last few years. The mom wears wigs all the time, and the dad's about bald and gone really gray. I told him at one point, I said, you know, if I thought they'd be easy to raise, I'd have kept them. Couldn't help it. And my job all along has been to be the one, and I told them, when they were 10, they figured out that our family was weird, you know, that their mother was older than their grandmother. And they couldn't, because they're boys, you know, it's not clueless, it's just clue-free. It's just a clue-free zone. That it never occurred to them that they didn't know who my child was, but they knew they were my grandchildren, you know, they just couldn't make the connection. They didn't realize Melissa was their mother, and the parents waited for them to ask questions, so they were about 10. Maybe they'd turned 11 before they asked that question, and we went through a year of that, of them talking to me about that. Didn't you want to keep me? Didn't you want me to be your little boy? And we talked it through, and I said, you know what? I wanted you to have somebody who'd love you no matter what. I wanted somebody who'd love you whether your room was clean or your homework was done or your hair was combed or you'd had a bath or anything. I wanted somebody to love you no matter what. If I'd had to be your mom, you wouldn't have had that. But it's something I can do and I want to do. And it's still my job, but it's getting harder and harder. The older of the twins, by 30 seconds, is back in jail again. He's been in jail more than not since October for one thing after another. There have been little petty things, mostly not paying tickets because he is, you know, bulletproof. They don't mean him, you know. This time they caught him on TV doing 138 miles an hour on his little motorcycle through his little town. And as God would have it, he ran out of gas before he hit anybody. And so he's in jail on multiple felonies now. And because he's been an FTA before, nobody wants to bond him out. And they've offered him 5 years of probation, take his license away. And he says, I can't be good for 5 years. So I think he's going to take 2 years in prison at the ripe old age of 20. The weird thing is there's no drug or alcohol involved. There's ism.
There's king-size-ism. I don't know that he's going to come out of prison with any more life tools than he's got now. And there aren't any 12-step programs for just, you know, bad decision-making kids. But that's where he is. My husband and I were talking about that coming up. It's too painful for me to go see him. I've written him letters, and he's written me letters, and I've sent him some money, and it's too painful. I was talking to my sponsor yesterday, and she said, "It's a burden on your heart, honey." I said, "It really is. It really is. I love that child. I love that child." I saw the newspaper article, and it didn't say Ellen's darling grandson. It said 20-year-old man is what it said, you know. And she taught me a sentence to say, because I called her yesterday, and I said, "What can I do? What can I do? Surely there's something I can do." You know, she used to say, "Honey, you have confused activity with progress." You think if you're doing something, you're getting somewhere, you know, and it's not true. She said yesterday, "Tell me the sentence. Tell me the problem. Tell me the problem in a sentence and use proper names. Don't use nouns. Don't use any pronouns." I said, "Okay, not my grandson is in jail, but Tony is in jail." "Grandson anywhere?" "No." "Okay, doesn't sound like your problem." "Okay. But, you know, my job's loving him no matter what." And that's what I told him in my little note. I said, "I just want you to know, your grandpa and I love you no matter what. Even if this was one of your poorest decisions, you know." I have so much to tell you, but I just can't tell you now. So here, I'll just tell you this part. About the time the babies left, I decided to stop dating. I'd done an inventory and discovered since I was 12, I've either been chasing after, catching, going with, waiting for, engaged to, married to, divorced from, waiting for, engaged to, married to, divorced from somebody, you know. But they'd always been somebody. I walk with this big empty hole beside me, and I keep throwing people in there to try to make me enough. And I'd like to tell you how special they all are, but I don't remember most of their names. And I decided if I was ever going to figure out who I was going to have to get unattached. I was going to have to be single. And if you're not going to hang out with boys, it leaves you one other choice. Girls. I mean, girls are okay, but I'm just not a girly girl. I'm just not. You know this, "Let's go shopping for the day." Shoot me dead, you know. I shop like a man. If you don't know what you want, don't go in there, you know. And when you find it, kill it and take it out, you know. And if you have something to say to me on the phone, for God's sake, say it. And hang up the phone. I'm busy. But now I'm with the girls. And so I'd pop the girls and I'd say, "I'm going to take my big old Suburban. We're going to go to the conference, you know, this weekend. And I'd love to have you ride with me. I have plenty of room. And if it'll, you know, if it takes, if you got to have 12 pairs of shoes for a 3-day conference, I can do the whole thing in my Nikes, you know, but if I got plenty of room, bring all your shoes." And every time you have to pee, we'll stop the car. I mean, girls are so weird. I could make it to Kansas, I'm pretty sure, you know, if I had to. But girls are like, you're riding down the road and they go, "Oh, look, there's a bathroom. Do I have to?" "Yes, I do. Pull in, you know. Didn't have to till they saw it, you know. That just wears me out. But anyway, okay, we'll stop. And the biggest concession was, every time we see a Walmart, we'll go in. You know? Walmart just overwhelms me. I mean, it's just too much stuff, you know. But I'll tell you something. I think there ought to be red neon crosses in the front of Walmart because healing happens in the aisles of Walmart. That's where I was healed. I was healed over a $5 bathing suit. We laughed so hard over that $5 bathing suit, I thought they'd have to call for cleanup on aisle 12, you know. Oh, we laughed our fannies off. It was the Walmart in Dumas, Texas. You know, just smelled awful. But God, it was fun. It was so fun. And you know what? I made an amazing discovery at the end of that time that I didn't date, which seemed like years, but I've counted up, and I think it was 8 months. Anyway, I always wanted God to speak to me in thunder and lightning, you know, because drama is my life. And God rolls his eyes and he goes, "Oh, sweetheart, if I did that one more time, you'd miss the message and get lost in the messenger." You know, God speaks to me in the language I understand best. And most of the time, that's another woman. 99 times out of 100, I know when I need help, that's where I need to go. And hanging out with them, I got a lesson. I'm enough. Nobody has to be added to make me okay. I'm enough. So then this guy asked me out.
And of course he did. And he wasn't in the program. And it was an old, I'd known him forever. I mean, we'd known each other probably 10 years at that point. I knew him through my job. He wasn't in the program. You know, and I wasn't going to get hung up with somebody who wasn't in the program anymore. And, of course, we're married now. Yeah. We've been married 16 years, actually. And we were married about 2 years, and we were going through a really, it was a horrible year. It was a wretched year. My mother died after a two-week illness. This baby I'd been taking care of died. And, oh, my, it was just one thing after another. And October came, and I was a basket case. And my sponsor said, you're going to do a written first step, and you're going to sit with me, and we're going to talk about it. And she said, I want to know the things that are infuriating you. Well, the first thing that was infuriating me was his snoring. I'd make up stories in the middle of the night about I was going to tell God what happened to him after I killed him, you know. And then the next thing I turned over was his drinking. He wasn't a bad drunk. He was always where he said he was going to be. He didn't come home and beat me. Well, it wasn't any of that. But when he came home and I opened the door, I'd go, hello. And if I smelled alcohol, my night went to hell in the handbasket. I needed to know that he could drink and I'd be okay. And an hour later, he walked up to the podium and said he was sick, and he hadn't had a drink since then. Best thing I ever did for him was get a program and get a life and get out of his way. And he's here. He's sitting in there. I can see him right there. 10. You're a good boy. That one back there was worrying me like I was almost done. Okay. Thank you, honey. I'm going to go longer, okay? 1997, my son called one time and he said, Mom, we want you to quit your job and come home. We're going to have a baby. We want you to take care of a baby. Now, the only people who ever saw me angry before I got to Al-Anon were my children. And they saw me rageful. I pinned them to the wall with my rage. And here was my son saying, we want you to stay home and take care of our baby. And my husband said, no. We need all the money you make, which was about $10. We need all that money. And I recognize, you know, financial insecurity when I see it, so I said, no, I can't do it. A couple of months later, my daughter called from California, and she said, guess what? I'm pregnant. And we're going to move home, and we want you to quit your job and stay home and take care of our baby.
No, you can't quit that job.
Well, after the first one was born, I happened to be in California, and Dick drove out there to meet me, and he was listening to some tapes on his way out. And I was talking to my son one night. I could hear my daughter-in-law crying in the background. Madison was about 4 months old at the time. And my son said, if I tell you one more horror story about what happened at the daycare today, then will you quit your job and stay home? And I told my husband, I said, we may have to eat beans in our old age, which is actually what's happening now. And but I said, you know, I don't regret the pastor wish to shut the door on it, but if I could change one thing, it was those days when my kids said, Mom, I don't feel good. I don't want to go to school. And I said, no, you have to go to school because I have to go to work. It wasn't that they wouldn't pay me if I didn't go. It was that it was the only place I had some power. It was a place I was needed, and I knew what to do, and I was as obsessed with that job as he ever had been with the bar. And I abandoned my children on a daily basis. I abandoned my children. I said, I wish I could change that, and I can't go back and change that. I couldn't be there for them then, but I can be here for them now. And he had listened to some Clint Hodges tapes on his way out, and he had heard somebody ask Clint, they said, exactly how much money would you have to have so you wouldn't feel financially insecure? And Clint said, oh, I guess just enough money so I wouldn't have to trust God. And Dick said, if you want to stay home, you can stay home. So I came home with four parts of the job, of course, because I couldn't leave it there. And, I mean, one little baby, how much time is she going to take, you know? And I opened a business, Moms Better Babies, an affordable daycare for your priceless children. But the only children I would keep are my grandchildren, don't ask. Madison came to me in August. She was exactly to the day, the same age the twins were the day we gave them up. God doesn't miss a beat. 4 months later, Tristan was born, and he came when he was 3 weeks old. And 14 months later, Kennedy was born, and she came when she was 4 weeks old. And 7 months later, Sutton was born, and he came when he was 2 months old. My son had two daughters. My daughter had two sons. They had sense enough to do it in 3 years. And I had the best job known to man. It was the best job known to man. I mean, you could go to work in your pajamas. You could sleep with your clients. They paid you to. Little people who loved you all day and would eat anything you put in front of them, you know. It was a great job. It was a great job. And then for the first time in my life, I experienced an empty nest. I had never had that with my kids, you know. I changed the locks on both of them. but I've had it with these little kids. And I still, you know, Dick and I still get the little kids on holidays and vacations and sick days. So we have them all summer. They actually came last Sunday night, and they didn't leave till 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon, and they'll be back Monday morning, and they're 11, 10, 9, and 8. We take them every summer to the Crested Butte Mountain Conference to be with 600 of our closest friends. I cannot keep alcoholism from affecting these children, but maybe, just maybe, I can make AA and Al-Anon a comfortable place for them to be, a place for them to turn to when that happens to them. I used to think that when I died and went to heaven, God was going to say, pull out the VCR and the tape, and I want to know how her husband and her children turned out. And if they turned out to be fine, upstanding members of the community, she's earned her way into heaven and she can come in. Thank God you let me find another God. Thank God you did. I don't know what's going to happen when we're done here, but you know me. I make up little stories and I live in them when I don't know what's happening. God says, my sponsor says this is a little story I can keep. I think that when this body of mine is through doing whatever in the world it is we're doing here, and that little part of me that's always been God's goes back to wherever it is God is. When I get there, God's going to go, oh, Ellen, there you are. You know, why would God greet me with less love than you do? And whose love do you greet me with but God's love? And he's going to say, oh, precious, you know what? Heaven's heaven when you're not here, but it's just not perfect without you. And then he's going to say, you know what, down there, nothing you could pass or fail, just a little experiment. I know you've been paying close attention. I'd like to have your opinion on how it's working. Yes, in my heaven, God wants my opinion, maybe. In yours, he'll want your opinion. He's going to say, first question is, did you have a good time? You know, I didn't do a single thing to torment you. I did everything I could to make your life happy, joyous, and free. There was no reason for flowers to be different colors, except I thought it'd make you smile. I knew you'd love babies, and I put a lot of them in your life, and I hope you didn't miss them. And because of you, I'm going to be able to say, oh, yes, God. I had a great time at your party. Thanks so much for asking me. And the second thing he's going to say is, were you Ellen? You were the only one like that I made. I had things for you to do that nobody else could do. I needed you to help me because my hands are too big. And that question worried me because I've spent so much of my life trying to be what I thought other people wanted me to be that I didn't know if I'd been me. Al-Anon has recovered me. I do a written inventory every night, and I've done it for a lot of years, and it changes. But when I realized that, for a couple of years, I wrote a line in there that said, today, Ellen. And I wrote down every day what had felt like mine to do that day so I'd know whether or not I was being me. This was mine to do today. You could have had another speaker and been done 15 minutes ago or so. That's not what happened to you. And the last thing he's going to say is, precious, did you ever get the joke? You know, I got the joke the year of cancer. I got the joke standing at the back door of my house with a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years with no hair on my body. It was all gone, all right? I'm not going to draw you pictures, but you get what I'm telling you? All gone, except for the gray, which was like fried nerve endings that kind of blew around in my head. And I would wear a little hat so I wouldn't offend you with my gray. And I got ready to go out, and I looked down and realized I was going to have to go back in and shave my legs. I'd lost all the hair except under my arms and on my legs. You know, I had a hot pink neon orange daughter living over the edge of the planet someplace. I had a husband who said, what's for dinner, and he might not come home for a week. I had a beige and navy blue son who was disappearing more and more and more and more every day, sleeping all day and staying up all night. And the fact of the matter is, right that minute, my life was wonderful. It was wonderful. I laughed till I thought my eyes would fall out. And that was the day I got the joke. I've spent so much of my life focused on what I don't have and what I'm afraid I'm going to lose that I almost missed the miracle of right now when everything I could possibly want is right here. This is perfect. This is exactly the way it's supposed to be. There was a guy in our group that said the glass isn't half big or half empty. The glass is half full or half empty. The glass is just too big. Bill Cosby says the glass is either half full or half empty, depending on whether you're drinking or pouring. The magic of what we do here is when I stand up here and pour, when I sit down, I'm the one whose cup overflows, and I thank you.